Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 34 of the Reformed Pubcast, your weekly podcast where we mix the world's oldest beverage, beer, with the world's oldest profession, podcasting, and the world's oldest book, Bible. I don't know.
What?
I need to check my facts, but I'm pretty sure that's all correct.
I think the world's oldest media, radio, would have worked. Who are you again? I don't know who you are. You haven't introduced yourself.
I'm your good eating host, Les.
And I am... I'm your morning booze host, Tanner.
So I've started a carpool with my supervisor from work. And we were having a conversation on the way home yesterday. And he was telling me how he watches Food Network all the time. We were talking about Alton Brown. And Tanner, you and I both really enjoy Alton Brown and Good Eats, right?
I am a fan. He taught me how to dice onions.
Yeah. Yeah, he's taught me so much. So many amazing things. I want to make a smoker because of his Junkyard episode where he made a smoker, like a cold smoker.
I saw the one where he made a smoker out of a clay pot.
I don't think I've seen that one.
He's made smokers out of a clay
pot. He makes so many smokers.
But anyways, what about Alton Brown?
It turns out Alton Brown is a Christian. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah, Alton Brown. I was reading some of my supervisor told me that, and I was kind of shocked. So I went online and I found some articles, some interviews, and he is totally like a legit Christian, and he talks about how that works with his faith and or with his his career, his TV personality and stuff. But I also came across this. This Vimeo video of him, he did this little like show or something called Gospel Grains, and he actually like researched the recipe for the barley bread that Jesus divides in John 6, and this whole episode he makes barley bread based on that, like what he thinks that recipe would be. It's pretty awesome. So you should definitely check it out if you get some time. Barley bread.
I will. I think, is that like using spent grains to make bread? Does he use spent?
No, it's not spent grains, but he like grinds them by hand, and he ends up using a food processor at some point.
Jesus didn't have a food processor. Anyways, so Les, what time is it?
It's 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that's not normal, right, for us to...
No, oh, well, the reason is because I screwed up real bad this week, real super bad. And didn't record your microphone. So we're re-recording on Wednesday at 9 o'clock in the morning.
When I just got off of work.
Yeah.
Which calls for morning booze.
Morning booze!
So we have a job to do, Les. And that job entails drinking beer on a podcast no matter what time we do it at.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
9 o'clock in the morning, done.
Yeah. Nothing like having a buzz before lunch. Or breakfast.
Speaking of beer... What's going on with this beer situation?
This beer is a gift. Yes. A generous gift.
That we have the best listeners in the world.
It was sent to us a few weeks ago, actually, but I was in the middle of a move, so I wasn't able to retrieve it.
It was probably pushing like a month ago that we got this.
Yeah. It was sent by a pubster, a fellow pub member, Gray Schuler, and he sent a note with it. It says, Les and Tanner, cheers and amen. And this is coming from Great Raft Brewing out of Shreveport, Louisiana.
Awesome.
And he sent us 2 6-packs. One of them was the Commotion American Pale Ale. And he sent IPL.
Southern Drawl Pale Lager.
Pale Lager.
Pale Lager. Very interesting. I've never had a Pale Lager before.
Indian Pale Lager, right?
It doesn't say Indian Pale Lager. It just says Pale Lager.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is really... really different than any lager I've ever had. It almost tastes like there's like a different yeast that
was
used.
It tastes very farmhousey.
Yeah.
Tastes like almost either like a Belgian wit. Definitely a lot of yeast character, which isn't typical for a lager. You don't usually have yeast characters usually mellow. But the pale ale is, I'd say it's classic pale ale. It's within the style. The lager, it doesn't seem to be in the style, but it's good. Everything's good. Really good brewery.
Absolutely. I cannot believe that our listeners are so awesome.
Some of them are awesome.
You know who you are.
The ones that send us beer. Right. The rest of you.
We need to have a talk.
I'm just kidding.
But seriously, thank you guys so much for caring enough to do that. We definitely don't deserve it. So
speaking,
thank you so much.
Speaking of beer gifts,
uh-huh.
I might have a surprise for you.
What you got?
I'm just going to play this.
Hey guys, it's Adam Moore, and a little Ninja Turtle told me that it was Les's birthday. So several of us in the pub got together, and we wanted to put together a little birthday present for Les. And so currently at the Total Wine in Port St. Lucie is a little package waiting for you, which includes Dogfish Head 90-Minute IPA, Old Rasputin Imperial Stout, a 12-pack of Stone, which includes Oaked Arrogant Bastard Ale, IPA, Ruination IPA, and Levitation Ale, Founders Porter, Victory Hop Devil, and Left Hand Milk Stout Nitro, which I've never had, but I really hope to have that soon. And so I'd like to give a shout out to the people who helped make this possible: Chris Orsini, Nicholas Jenkins, Brandon Solberg, Chase Steely, Martin McNamara, Zeb Carpenter, Daniel Stafer, Owen Pawn, Joycelyn Young, and Levi Gray. And we're also appreciative and grateful for what you guys do week in and week out. And we really appreciate the community group that you've created for us online, and just the ability to talk about the things of the Lord, talk about things that we love, theological and non-theological, and we really appreciate that. So we hope you have a happy birthday, and cheers and amen.
Oh, man. That is incredible.
What do you think about that there, Les?
I think that's amazing. So there's just like a care package chilling at Total Wine.
Yeah, it's just sitting there waiting for you.
It's like 100 beers.
Yeah, you're gonna
that's amazing.
You're gonna be busy.
What have you guys done to me? Thank you so much. That's amazing. I cannot believe you guys would do that.
There's not gonna be anything left for my birthday, Les. You should save me one of those milk stouts.
Absolutely.
My birthday's August 16th. And the resources have been tapped. It should be mentioned that Adam Moore is the one who organized all of that.
Yeah, dude.
Straight up just thought of you and made a Facebook group and did that. It's pretty amazing.
Unbelievable. The pub. They take care of us.
They sure do.
They love us. Oh man, thank you guys so much. I'm shocked. That's so awesome. Man. Well, if you guys out there would like to contact us, you can join our Facebook group called The Reformed Pub. That's where we talk about beer and theology, and that's where all the guys that spoiled us, that's where they hang out in the pub.
So if you want to come spoil us too,
feel free. You can follow us on Twitter at Reformed Pubcast. You can email us reformedpub@gmail.com, and you can always leave us voicemails by calling 772-405-7327. I actually wanted to read a quick email that we just got this morning.
Go for it.
It's from Tanner. Not you, Tanner. A different Tanner. In Dallas, Texas. Hmm. He says, "Hey guys, just started listening to the show and I'm enjoying it. A couple episodes ago, the question was posed in lieu of the story where David brings Saul 200 Philistine foreskins in exchange for my call. What does the hospital do with all the foreskins? Well, my buddy Scott just got a brand new job in the medical field. What does he do? He sells a regenerative material to doctors and surgeons performing skin grafts for burn victims. That material is made of infantile foreskins. Reason being, the foreskin is apparently the most regenerative skin on the human body. Lydia was a seller of purple goods. My friend is a seller of foreskins. So now you know what they do with all those foreskins." Tanner, Dallas, Texas.
All
awesome.
Right.
Awesome.
So you're telling me there's a bunch of people walking around with foreskins all over their body from all those grafts?
Yeah. And there might very well be a black market for foreskins, as you mentioned on the show.
Wow.
Let's listen to some voicemails.
All right, here we go.
Hey guys, this is Joey Daniels calling from Morristown, Tennessee. I just wanted to get your opinion on something that I've been thinking about lately. The idea, I suppose, is about feeling sorrow in heaven. This is something that I've heard R.C. Sproul talk about, and I've even read Charles Spurgeon write about this, but I guess the idea is that when someone we love on earth, our parents, a spouse, our children, die and go to hell, that when we are in heaven, we will actually praise God for that. And the idea is that on earth, human relationships are kind of the highest thing that we have. And so when someone we love goes to hell, it's very sorrowful. And of course, it is sad that they're suffering in hell for eternity. And that's a terrible thing. But once we get to heaven, we will not only have different relationships humanly, but that we will understand God in ways that we can't right now in our glorified bodies. And so that we will look down from heaven, perhaps even on our own parents in hell, and we will praise God for that, because we will see that he is glorified through his justice, through his righteousness, through his holiness. And that, you know, the, we will see that differently. So I just wondered what you guys thought about that, because that's definitely something that's, I guess, difficult to accept or difficult to think about. And so I just wondered what your opinions on that. And I guess to that end, the idea of experiencing sorrow in heaven at all, do you think that when Christ is going to be there to wipe our tears away, do you think that means he will remove our sorrow? Or do you think that that means that we will still feel sorrow, perhaps remorse for things that we did on earth and at Christ? So I'm interested in hearing your thoughts, but cheers.
Cheers. Wow, that's a heavy topic. So I've actually, I know someone who went to Ligonier and they heard like R.C. Sproul say this like as bluntly as he, as I've ever heard him say it. He basically just said like, when you're in heaven, you'll be able to look down on your own mother burning in hell and, you know, just praise God and be happy about it. Which... obviously I think there's ultimately truth there, but, it's a pretty harsh way to say it probably. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there's a difference between, I don't know. I think in the subject, like looking at what R.C. Sproul said, I think it ignores the emotional aspect of human beings, like that we are made with emotions, and so it might be the truth, but to state something so bluntly as that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, the reality is that God will be praised for his character as a whole. And so that entails, the fact that he's pouring wrath out on those who deserve his wrath. And that as Christians in heaven, part of God's family, who have been shown grace, knowing what we deserve, watching others being punished and getting the punishment that we deserve, will be praising God for his grace upon us. But yet his justice is, you know, is being carried out, and his wrath is being poured out on the unrighteous. So I don't know. It's tough.
Yeah. There's like there is that completion to all of human history and all of the rebellion of the world being dealt with. And that is a very, very good thing. So I think it's ultimately a right thing to say. And we will be praising God for his justice. And, I would say relationships are pretty dramatically changed in heaven as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we're married now, and in heaven we won't have wives. Something drastically is going to change about the way that we relate to people.
Right, and won't, like, being in heaven, won't our minds be completely aligned with
the will of God?
With the will of God. Mm-hmm. So I guess we just have to look at how God sees his justice being served. And, you know, I think that God delights in his character and his holiness and in being just, but he also doesn't desire that anyone should perish. So it's not something that he's excited about. I don't think the Bible paints a picture of God being like loving the fact that his creation has rebelled against him, and,
right.
and now he has to pour out wrath upon in order to be just. And I think that there's something that we can relate to in that being made in the character of God. We can relate in the fact that, you know, when someone does something really evil, we want justice to be served, but we're not happy that the person did it, and we're not happy that this is how it has to end.
Yeah.
You know?
But we're happy that justice is served.
Right. And I think a family who's experienced maybe someone murdering somebody else in their family and watching this person maybe die with the death penalty or something like that, I think that they could probably understand a little bit what that feels like.
Yeah.
That, you know, or even let's say the mother of a serial killer watching her son, you know, be put to death, you know,
yeah.
think about that. I mean, the mother is probably just appalled at what her son's done, but she knows, I mean, if she's a normal human being with emotions and empathy, she knows that her son has done terrible things to people. And despite how much she cares about him, you know, I think most sane mothers of serial killers or killers in general that have been killed, I think if you were to interview them and talk to them, they would say like he was a monster, like, and he justice was served. I'm his mother. I don't like the fact that he died. I don't like the fact that he did what he did, but that's just the reality of it. And I think that that's kind of like in R.C. Sproul's statement, that's more congruent with what he's saying, like in the sense that you can't take somebody who was a victim of that sin. You have to take somebody who was maybe in a family, because we're going to have family members possibly, or people we really care about in hell and looking down on them. So what's that like to see somebody on earth? What's those emotions like to see somebody put to death on earth, but justice being served, I guess? And then also, what does God say about it? And it says that he doesn't delight in it. So I think that says something.
Yeah. You know? And he had like a more ultimate question too of like, is there sorrow at all in heaven? And I think that sorrow is a result of sin, I would say. That seems to make sense. Like it's that we're sinned against, we sin, and all of these circumstances end up with penalties, with you know, consequences, and those consequences lead to sorrow. And once all of that is removed, there's no more sin in the world. There's no more sin in our hearts. There's only being aligned with the mind of God, and all of our sin is dealt with in Christ. So that leads to praise. I don't think that it would make any sense that we would have sorrow in heaven. And I think that's the picture that the Bible paints, that all of our tears will be wiped away, and we won't have those negative emotions anymore. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it just depends on what. Like, is sorrow what God feels when he deals out that wrath upon the unrighteous? I mean, when he says that he doesn't delight in it,
I don't think it's sorrow. I think that he is displeased that his creation is rebelling against him, but the fact that he's completely satisfied in the end by justice being served. So like that idea of propitiation in Christ, like, he's completely satisfied in Christ receiving our punishment, but if Christ doesn't receive your punishment, you will receive your own, and then he is also completely satisfied. So I think part of that statement that God does not delight in the death of the wicked, like, his not delighting is a part of his wrath. Like, he's furiously angry with his creation who would rebel against him, which makes him not happy, and he does not delight that they are doing it, and that is ultimately his wrath, and his wrath is spent and satisfied in hell or with Christ.
Mm.
That's sort of my thoughts.
I think that's good.
Cool. We got some more voicemails.
Yeah.
Hey guys, this is Pastor Adam Powers in Newport Richey, Florida. I'm the pastor of Sunrise Community Church, and I just want to say thank you. I listened to your podcast for the first time today, and it was very good. I really enjoyed it. I love beer and I love theology, and so I really enjoyed what you had to say. And I think you had Pastor Tullian Chevechin on the episode I listened to. It was very good. And I'm a brand new pastor. I'm 30 years old, and young, reformed, and restless. And I find very much solace in your podcast and hearts unified for the gospel. So thank you for that, and appreciate you much. Alrighty, bye.
Pastor Adam, thank you so much. That's pretty darn encouraging.
Yeah. It's great to hear another young, restless, and reformed dude coming up through the ranks and being a pastor. And
a 30-year-old pastor. That's crazy.
Yeah. And loving the podcast. That's encouraging for sure.
Yeah. Have one on us. I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
But
cheers and amen.
Cheers and amen.
So the next voicemail is pretty special. We're going to play this. It's kind of long, but here we go.
Hey, Tanner and Les, this is Sean Miller. I'm a chemist at Dogfish Head. A couple weeks back, you guys asked what exactly I did, and my coworkers did on a day-to-day basis at Dogfish. So I thought about it and figured out all of the things that we did, so I can tell you a little bit about that. So every day we check the action fermentations in all of our fermenters. We have a analyzer called the alkalizer. The alkalizer will tell us our ABV, our calculated original gravity, our specific gravity, our Play-Doh, and our density of our beer. And we can use that to make sure all of our fermentations are fermenting at the right speed, so that way we don't get any off flavors, and we want to make sure that we're not having any tanks that are stalling in fermentation and things like that, so we check that every single day. Then we have a UV visible light spectrophotometer. With that, we can measure IBUs, which are International Bitterness Units. We can measure SRM, which is a standard reference method unit, which is the color of the beer. And we can do iron analysis on our beer because nobody likes iron in their beer, so it tastes like you're drinking blood if that would happen. So we always make sure that we don't have that, and if we suspect there may be a problem. We also have a haze meter. So when you look at our 60-minute, you know, it's bright and brilliant and crystal clear. But when you look at our Namaste, which is a wit beer, it's nice and cloudy and great for the style. So we don't want to be putting out any 60-minute that looks like our Namaste. So we can put actual values on that haze. We also have an HPLC, which is a high-performance liquid chromatograph. One of my friends likes to describe this instrument as if we take the color purple and run it through that instrument, we can separate purple into blue and red and quantitate how much blue is in there and how much red is in there. So what we can do, we can take wort samples or we can take fermenter samples and run it through and see what simple sugars we have in there. So, you know, we have two different brew houses at Dogfish, so you know, we've done a lot of work to make sure our mashes are producing the same sugars. So that's a really important instrument. We also have portable dissolved oxygen meters and CO2 meters. The oxygen meters are important because oxygen in beer is no good. We get, you know, cardboard, dull flavor from having oxygen in beer. And then we test the CO2 to make sure, you know, that you're not getting a beer that explodes like champagne and it's not flat. We want it just right. And then we also have a total package analyzer, which will measure dissolved oxygen and carbon dioxide within the package, and it can tell us where the oxygen is, if it's in the head space or it's in the liquid, and it'll tell us our CO2 value. So those are very important for our packaging line. We also do microbiological testing on a daily basis. Every new fermenter, we test for microbes. We'll test dry hops. After we dry hop a beer, we'll test when it's in our bright beer tank, which means it's beer that's ready to go and ready to be packaged. And then we'll test once it's in the package, and we'll also test yeast harvest and yeast propagation. You know, microbiological testing is very important because if you get a wild yeast or you get, you know, Brettanomyces in your beer, you don't want that to go out because it won't taste the right way. And then we have everybody's favorite thing in the whole world to talk about is sensory. And every day we have a tasting panel where, you know, people that are good tasters come to the sensory room. They sit down at a booth and They get served beers, and then we write down, is it true to type or not? You know, if we get a 60-minute, it doesn't taste quite like 60 minutes. That doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we brewed it funkier, we messed up. You know, there's, you know, hops are variable. Different years have different flavors, even though it's the same exact kind of hops. So, you know, every once in a while we just get one of these beers that tastes just slightly different for one reason or another, and we have a great sensory guy who will blend that 60 minutes that may be off, not because we did anything wrong, just it just happens by nature, with another one, and they do a great job, so it tastes great every time. So that's pretty much all we do on a daily basis. There's all kinds of other crazy tests that we do. You know, we put a lot of hard work into getting the beer out, but yeah, that's what we do. So, hey, Wes and Tanner, I love the podcast. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to listening to the next cast. See ya.
Sean.
Holy cow.
Sean, you should be the tour guide, dude.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Yeah, so anybody who didn't know how beer was made kind of got, like, an idea of how it's done and how they check it and stuff. There was a lot of that explanation in there.
What an awesome brewery to have the explanation for, too.
Yeah, Dogfish Head, like, the brewery that, like, between them and Sierra Nevada, like, the two breweries that really ushered in. The owner of Dogfish, Sam, has done probably more for the craft beer industry than, like, anyone. He's, like, a huge spokesman. He's seems like the nicest dude. I mean, I've seen interviews with him, like long interviews. Not the Brewing Network, but Brew TV for Northern Brewer did like an hour long interview with him, and he just seems like the coolest dude. Did you ever hear that thing that he wrote, the letter he wrote to like ratebeer.com or beeradvocate.com or whatever?
We talked about it on the show. I think we read some of it.
Yeah, he kind of like came down on the community, and he's just, the guy loves beer and he runs a great company, and everybody who works for him seems to really love their job and respect the company and respect what they do. Like Sean, like before he called us, like he made sure that they were cool with him calling and making sure that, you know, like he wouldn't give away, probably not give away any secrets or anything like that, I imagine. But so that's cool that, you know, that I think the company just, you know, invites like such a respect. I know I respect the company a lot. I think what they, I mean, my first craft beer was 90 minute IPA. So, yeah, it's awesome. Thank you, Sean, for calling in. I was geeking out over here. It was really, really cool.
That was absolutely awesome.
All right, Les, I've got a game. This one's coming in from mentalfloss.com.
Nice.
Okay. It's called The Drinking Game, an alcohol history quiz.
Ooh.
So in order to do this, I had to go ahead and play it and get the answer. So I'm just going to pose the questions to you.
Okay.
And there's 12 questions. So if you get more than 50% right, you get to go first.
Sweet.
All right. Here we go. Captain Morgan, actual buccaneer or marketing invention?
Marketing invention.
Wrong. Actual buccaneer. In the 17th century, Morgan was a feared privateer. Not only did the Welsh pirate marry his own cousin, he ran risky missions for the governor of Jamaica, including capturing some Spanish prisoners in Cuba and sacking Port-au-Prince in Haiti. He then plundered the Cuban coast before holding for ransom entire city of Portobello, Panama. He later looted and burned Panama City, and his pillaging career came to an end when Spain and England signed a peace treaty in 1671. Instead of getting in trouble for his high seas antics, Morgan received knighthood and became the lieutenant governor of Jamaica.
Wow.
So he got gifted for being a
pirate.
Kind of a terrible person. Question number two. Which large brewer started an offshoot company that became one of the world's largest industrial ceramic makers? So is it Coors? Is it Molson? Or is it Anheuser-Busch?
Molson.
Incorrect.
Coors.
Coors. When Prohibition came to Colorado in 1916, 3 years before the rest of the country went dry, Adolf Coors kept his business afloat by making malted milk and focusing on the family ceramic business, which is now known as Coors Tech, one of the world's largest industrial ceramic companies.
Wow.
True or false, bourbon can only be made in Kentucky.
True.
False.
Jeez.
It's a common misconception, though. Kentucky straight bourbon can only be made in Bluegrass State, but a handful of other bourbon distilleries are sprinkled around the country. Among them, Tuthill Town Spirits in New York makes its own Hudson Baby Bourbon, which is aged for just 3 months, and A. Smith Bowman Distillery of Virginia makes, among other products, a yummy 90-proof small-batch bourbon under its Virginia Gentleman label. And I have to say that yummy should never be used to describe how bourbon tastes. It's a very emasculated word.
Yummy.
Yummy. Number four. What malt liquor once ran a series of ads in which Ice Cube rapped about how it was better than the rest? Better than the rest, in quotation marks. Is it St. Ides or Old English?
Old English.
Nope.
Oh, my gosh.
St. Ides. The malt liquor has actually used a number of famous rappers in its advertisement, with everyone from Snoop Dogg to the Wu-Tang Clan to Dr. Dre dropping original rhymes to help sell 40s. Number five. What brewer has a 9,000-year lease on its brewing facility? I know the answer to this. Is it Guinness, Newcastle, or Deschutes?
Guinness.
It's Guinness.
Yes, I got one. Yes. Tanner. Tanner, I got one.
Yeah.
I did it.
St. James Gate is, that's a 9,000-year lease. What question number six, what business was Johnny Walker originally in before he started marketing whiskey? Is it farming, plumbing, groceries, or I don't know. I can't come up with anything else. Well, he's farming, plumbing, or groceries.
Johnny Walker is a fancy gentleman. Maybe it wasn't him, though. I'm going to say groceries.
He was a grocer.
Yes. Tanner, I did it again.
Should I read? No, I'm not going to read it. It's boring about how he was a grocer. Question seven, what country set the historical precedent for making 21 the legal drinking age? Was it the United States? Was it England? Or was it Germany?
Germany.
Wrong.
Dang it.
The Germans? You really think the Germans would do that?
I figured it was...
it was England. That's what I thought. Did lawmakers just pick 21 out of a hat because they wanted college seniors to learn the nuances of bar culture before graduation? Not quite. The concept that a person becomes a full adult age 21 dates back centuries in English common law. 21 was the age at which a person could, among other things, vote and become a knight. Since a person was an official adult at age 21, it seemed to make sense that they could drink then too. We won't go there because it's political. Question number eight...
Drink.
What beer was invented to get around a Major League Baseball rule? Was it Busch, Budweiser, Miller, or...
I don't know. Busch.
Correct.
Okay.
If you thought Anheuser-Busch's only advertising breakthrough were Clydesdales and Talking Frogs, think again. In 1953, the brewery wanted to buy the naming rights for Sportsman's Park, the home of the St. Louis Cardinals, and renamed the park Budweiser Stadium. National League president Ford C. Frick wasn't so hot on naming a stadium after booze, but he allowed Augustus Busch to stick his family's surname on the park. The Cardinals opened the 1954 season in Busch Stadium. Anheuser-Busch quickly rolled out Busch Bavarian Beer to take advantage of this advertising.
Busch.
Question nine. What slogan did the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms forced Coors Light to drop because it was misleading? Was it, it won't slow you down, or tap the Rockies?
It won't slow you down. No, tap the Rockies.
They still use tap the Rockies.
It won't slow you down. The first one I said.
It won't slow you down.
I already lost this game pretty bad.
It's fun. It's fun watching you lose. We'll go to the last one. According to legend, the Manhattan was invented for a party thrown by what future world leader's mother? Was it John F. Kennedy, Winston Churchill, or Roosevelt?
Churchill.
Incorrect.
Kennedy.
Churchill was from England. Why would they call it Manhattan? I know.
Are we done here?
We're done here.
Okay,
so
Tanner
I need to
goes
go
first.
First. Okay. I want to talk about warp drive, spaceship concept.
Okay.
Back to geek.
Uh-huh.
So NASA's playing it pretty close here to the chest. They have a warp drive that physicists think will work, and they're not rolling it out and using it.
Tell me, what is warp drive?
Okay, I'm going to tell you. Get ready for this. All right? So basically, this Dr. Harold White, he's the lead at NASA's Eagle Works Advanced Propulsion Physics Laboratory, who also works in ion engines and plasma thrusters.
Dr. White, man. Another Dr. White.
Dr. White, whose daily life is working in future propulsion solutions for interplanetary travel in the near future, like ion and plasma thrusters, developed new theoretical work that solved the problems of Alcubierre drive concept, a theory that allowed faster-than-light travel, great game, based on Einstein's field equations in general relativity developed by theoretical physicist Miguel Alcubierre. So this spaceship, if it's equipped with a warp drive, would allow faster-than-light travel, and it does it by bending the space around it. So it makes distances in between places shorter by bending them on themselves. Okay?
Oh, boy.
So at the local level, however, the spaceship wouldn't be moving faster than light. Therefore, warp drive travel doesn't violate the first Einstein commandment, thou shalt not travel faster than light. So it's actually not really traveling that fast. It's just making distances closer to themselves. And it does that somehow by, like, creating a mini black hole or something.
Jeez.
So NASA has, like, all of this technology, like, there. And they're basically, like, holding off on it. I don't know if it's a money issue. The article says, the feasibility of building a space-bending warp drive aside, I don't care how we get out of the solar system to go explore other worlds, just as long as we do it. If you told me you could shoot me out of a cannon to Alpha Centauri 1, or Alpha Centauri, I would already have my crash helmet on. The sad fact is NASA will never receive the funding to build an interstellar spaceship. People don't care enough. NASA would be lucky to receive the funding to build a model of the spaceship out of popsicle sticks. So, apparently the issue is funding.
Wow.
What do you think about this, Les? Like, what if somehow this happens? What does this mean?
Why are we doing this? Why do we want to go to these far reaches?
I do.
Why?
That would be amazing.
Why?
To bend space on itself travel there?
That's definitely cool.
To see more of God's creation? That would be sweet. I just God creation juked that whole thing.
Yeah, which is kind of what we have to do, or else we're just talking about this.
All right, quick, make it theological.
I think you already did.
That's what I wanted. I want to see the universe, man. I would totally. If I had the money, I'd fund it.
So you just go and look at planets that you can't touch. You can't, like, go. I mean, I guess.
Can you touch the lions at the zoo, Les? Does it stop you from going there and looking at them?
You technically could touch the lions at the zoo. They, like,
usually they're behind things that keep you from touching them.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like,
they're not in, like, cages like in those child books.
If you went to,
or Curious George, who's really an ape,
the curious little monkey,
the curious little ape, chimp.
I don't know. Like, you can't stand on these. Well, I guess you could. I don't know. I don't know. I just don't. I don't. Maybe I'm not as excited about it. I'm excited about the idea.
How are you not excited about the fact that we can bend space on itself and travel shorter distances?
That is incredible. But I don't want to be in the spaceship that does it. I want to see what happens to the spaceship, because nobody has any idea what would happen to it.
I volunteer as tribute.
You'd probably be disintegrated.
That's fine.
Or something.
It's fine. I'll be in glory.
It's probably the least painful way to die. Disintegration. Immediate disintegration.
No, it's like you just made me think of a Star Wars reference when he's got all the bounty hunters on the Star Destroyer, and Darth Vader's talking to all of the bounty hunters, and he walks past Boba Fett, and he looks at Boba Fett, and he's like, "No disintegrations," and Boba Fett, like, kind of nods at him.
He's like, "All right, yeah. All right.
I'll just flamethrow him and burn him to death.
Yep,
bring back your charred little Jedi boy."
Much more painful. So I think the disintegration or the interstellar idea is really cool. I'm just don't really care about.
I think there's a movie coming out.
It's all rocks. It's just rocks out there, right? Different sized rocks, planets,
fireballs.
Fireballs. Why you want to go look at fireballs and big rocks?
Because it's cool, man.
I guess
people stargaze.
Yeah, stargazing is cool because it's like beautiful, like this.
You don't think that seeing like a crazy star up close would be beautiful?
That sounds like fire. It's just fire. I know what fire looks like.
You never stared at the sun as a kid, Les?
You're not supposed to do that.
I know.
My mom told me not to.
Okay, what's your topic, Les?
I was teaching my daughter how to ride her bike over the past week, and it was really cool. So this is a secret. Don't tell Matthew. But she's learning way, way, way faster than Matthew ever did. And I observe as a father like what's going on, and it's really clear that she's
smarter than Matthew.
Well, no, she's like trying to outdo him. You know, it's like, oh, well, he can do it, so I can do it too. And Matthew didn't have that sort of carrot hanging in front of him of like impressing everybody and showing up your sibling. So it's for him, it was just like, I'm going to learn how to do this thing, and this is what my dad is telling me to do, so I'm going to do it, and this is the way I'm going to learn. While Sarah has this very like present, like, my brother can do this, and I'm going to be able to do it immediately. So she learned like in a day what it took him like 3 days to learn, and now she's already like fully riding the bike, and it didn't.
Did you taunt Matthew?
Did I taunt him?
Yeah. Were you like, Matthew, your sister's three times better than you?
No, I did not taunt. No. I didn't taunt my son. But it brought to mind a conversation that I was actually having with Raleigh Donahue. It was based on a conversation that we had around Common Grace at one point on the show.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about this idea of like basically like what is free will and the choices we make. Because I was saying like basically every choice that I make is ultimately at least somewhat selfish, right? Remember that conversation we had?
Yeah.
And if for an unbeliever, it's ultimately completely selfish, I would say, because at the end of the day, you're not glorifying God in the things you do. You're actually doing something that's beneficial to you. So Raleigh and I had this sort of discussion. And I don't know, it makes me, I just wanted to talk about like the nature of decisions and the nature of like free will choices and stuff like that. Because like in the bondage of the will and, throughout Reformed history, they've talked about this idea that like, that basically every choice that you make is at that given moment, the thing that is most appealing to you, right?
Yep.
So I would say, like, basically every decision that you make is cost-benefit analysis, like, you know, ultimately in your mind. And you're thinking about, what do I want the most, and which of these choices will give me the thing that I want the most? And that doesn't necessarily mean, like, immediate gratification. You could want something greater in the long run, like your reputation to look better, or for people at work to view you in a certain way. Or it might be instant gratification, so you commit the crime like immediately. So, and I sort of have this very utilitarian view of will, you know, free will and choices and stuff like that. And I think some people disagree with that, and which is fine. But I don't know, Tanner. Do you have any thoughts on how that works? And because I think like ultimately that's the way that we operate. Like everything is always what we want the most. And then for a Christian, you know, you work in that idea of like, now there's the will of God, and now you have this king that you want to serve and you want his approval. So now there's a different benefit, the approval of God, right?
Yeah, I think it's different though when you're a Christian. I don't think it's a cost benefit analysis.
Okay, let's talk about it. What do you think? What do you mean?
I just think that for me, it doesn't feel, it's not about like me sitting there weighing like the costs that are going to come. I mean, there is weighing of costs. I mean, I weigh like, you know, I don't know. I don't know how, what to, let's say being faithful to my wife. Okay. So, you know, if I'm put in a situation where I feel tempted to not be faithful to my wife, there's the obvious things like if she finds out, it'll hurt her. I could lose my, you know, I could lose my family. I could lose her. You know, I could lose, you know, I could be under church discipline. And
your reputation,
my reputation among other Christians. So there's that. But ultimately there's those things, but ultimately what it comes down to is, just this like feeling in your heart that kind of, I mean, I know that there's Christians who, aren't faithful to their spouses and they end up, you know, falling into sin and given to temptation. But I think that there is a moment for a Christian where when you're in that position, you really have to quiet this like new principle that you have, this new moral that you have that's there, that's kind of just on your heart, that says like, this just isn't right. This doesn't feel right. It's not right. It's just not good for you. And I think that goes above and beyond like the consequences that are there. You just don't feel right doing it. It doesn't feel the same as when, you know, when you're not a Christian, if you can get away with it, and it serves you, then who cares? But even if you can get away with it if you're a Christian and you know you can get away with it, you know, no one will ever find out. It still doesn't feel right.
Right. So this is like lay philosophy almost, like the stuff we're talking about right now. But I think it's kind of useful. But okay, so right, I agree with everything you just said. But the way that I see that is, God has written His law on the hearts of all men, right? So we do to some small degree, we do to a full degree understand what's right and wrong, but we suppress it in various ways as unbelievers, and So you know that what you're about to do is wrong, but you don't care because the value of either what you will immediately receive or what you'll get in the long run, like you know, people run long grifts and stuff to like steal money and stuff like that. So then as a Christian, once we are regenerated, our eyes are actually open to a reality that literally didn't exist before. It didn't enter into the equation at all. So now we have this whole new value system that nobody else is even experiencing. So now when we're faced with that same tinge of immorality, it's heightened so much because we know that literally the eyes of God are on us at that moment. He sees what we're doing, and we want... So now we have this community around us that holds us accountable, which is a means by which God, I think, you know, holds us to a moral standard. We have our families, we have, you know, we have the Word of God, but then ultimately we have the judge who we know is seeing us and who we know is going to keep account of our life, and we want to positively please Him. So obviously we don't always do the right thing, but now we have this whole new system of benefits and system of things that we want that unbelievers simply don't even care about. It doesn't even enter into their radar. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I think, I don't know, it might be a different experience for other people. For me, yeah, you know, I think about the wrath of God. I think about pleasing Him. I think about the cross and making it a sham when I sin. Those things are all present, but I think ultimately what it comes down to is this thing, and it's like something in my gut that says I'm disturbing peace within me. Like by sinning, when I sin, I feel like there's this peace about me when I'm not sinning, when I'm you know, following the law of God and living in harmony with my new heart. But when my flesh goes against my new nature and sins, it's like chaos in my body. And I guess so. If you want to break it down to its simplest form of cost versus benefit, the cost is I lose this peace that I have.
Sure, that enters
and for me, that's more of the experience that I have. Like, I don't think so much about like the discipline that comes from God. I don't, you know, I know it's there. I know it happens, but that's not really what I really think about. What I think about is disturbing this inner peace that I have that is given to me when I am living in accordance with my new heart that has new desires.
But okay, so do you think that turning off of peace is like this existential switch that happens without like any thought process going on in your mind? Or do you think it is like a personal realization, like, oh no, like I have failed God?
I don't think any Christian I don't think any Christian feels at peace sinning.
No, that's what I'm saying.
I think that's what brings them back to the foot of the cross.
But I'm saying, what is the nature of that peace? And is it something you've realized that removes that peace? So like if I was unfaithful to my wife, I think there would be suddenly this personal lack of peace, even if my wife hadn't found out yet.
Yeah.
There'd be this block between us. And it's not just that a switch went off. It's that now I understand my sin, even though she doesn't. So now there's a problem, and now the peace is broken between us. So it's a personal relationship that broke the peace. And I think that that's the same thing with God. Like, when I sin, the reason that peace has gone away is because now personally, on a personal level, the relationship between my Father and I has been disrupted, and I understand that. So now I no longer have peace. And there's a spiritual reality. You know, the Holy Spirit does convict us of our sin because, unlike my wife, he does know immediately. You know, there's no like time when he's not, you know, it's just me knowing. So there's a conviction coming from the Spirit as well. But I'm just saying, like, that lack of peace isn't just like this existential like unsubstance thing. It really is like a relationship that's broken, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me.
So I don't know. I was just thinking about, you know, the relationship of what free will is and the choices we make. And I guess that's kind of my understanding. I know a lot of people have different understandings of it, but I don't know. I think it's fun to think
about.
I'm
sure everybody's experience, the way they would describe it, is different. But I think for the most part, you know, I think what, you know, when we talk about perseverance of the saints, I think that God uses that. You know, this is what's so important about talking about regeneration and this new nature that's in us, is that you have to understand that there is like this change that takes place within you, and it's a spiritual, you know, like tons of religions talk about inner peace, and, you know, Oprah talks about all this inner peace, but I, as a Christian, there is this peace that exists when my flesh isn't living antithetical to the way my heart has been changed and the desires that it has.
Right.
So when everything is in accord, is going accordingly to what God has commanded of me, my heart is satisfied. My heart is glad because my heart desires those things. My heart is glad that my flesh is not warring against the desires that it has. And it's just kind of weird because, like, the heart doesn't have limbs, and it doesn't have, like, but I view our flesh as what has limbs. And so it's almost like your heart's screaming at you, like, stop, just stop doing what you're doing with your limbs. Like, stop, just, you know, listen to me. Let me control the, you know, the flesh. Like, you know, whatever, it's like this, I don't know. It's just like imagery that I have in my head. Like, the flesh is just doing whatever it wants, and it has no mind. It's just doing, it's, you know, what it used to do. And the
Romans
heart,
7, man.
The heart is perfect. The heart is the new guide. It's the new director, and the heart's screaming at the flesh as it's flopping around doing whatever it's doing and bringing it back into order. And that's how I feel when I'm in sin, is that I, like, my flesh is just flailing about, and my heart's just screaming at it to stop.
That's exactly Romans 7. I've been spending a lot of time with it. My son, the other day at the table, at the kitchen table, we were talking about, like, I don't know, he was disobeying in something earlier in the day. And he sat there, And we said, like, you know, you need to listen. And when we say these things or whatever, and he just busted out into tears. And he's like, I can't. And we're like, all right. We're like trying to be sympathetic, but we're like, but yes, you can. And he's like, I know I can, but I can't. And he just kept crying. And I was like, oh man, like that's exactly Romans 7.
Yeah.
Like the things I want to do, I can't do. There's this war going on between my mind and my members. It's exactly right. Like your body is warring against your new heart, your new desires.
I think that's why if you have a community of Christians that aren't actively talking about sin and confessing constantly, there's a problem.
Yeah.
And I think there obviously needs to be some type of, I don't think you need to go into gross detail, but if you have a community of Christians, close friends that aren't confessing sins, then like it's almost like you're ignoring the fact that we are all not doing what we want to do and doing what we ought not to do. And I think that it's just that kind of conversation, you know, having conversations with fellow Christians about sin that's going on and not talk, being open about it and it being safe to talk about it, but not obviously not so safe that it feels like it's not a big deal. But you know, I think that that's practicing out that, you know, acknowledging that that verse is there and doing something about it, saying like, yeah, we're all doing what we shouldn't be doing, and bringing it out in the light, talking about it is going to help us, you know, rail it back in. Cause like the first thing people do when they sin is that they try to figure out how they don't have to tell anybody. Like, how can I'll just stop this and I won't tell anybody. And then I don't have to deal with the consequences that are there with personnel and stuff like that. But the reality is the quickest way to stop it is to just bring it out. You know, the quickest way to stop it is to say, I sinned in this way. And that's why we have things like, you know, I think, you know, not enough Christians don't practice like not taking communion when they're living, you know, in an unrepentant sin.
Yeah.
And that's something that's hugely important. Just bringing that out, you know, and bringing out that loss of inner peace that's going on and confessing it and being honest about not doing what we should be doing. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. This probably seem very disconnected, but to tie it back to what I was saying about like my daughter and the whole bike thing, like I think this whole, you know, it sounds kind of simplistic to say cost benefit, but I kind of, you know, that's the simplest way that I can explain it. So I don't necessarily think that the fact that everything we do is based on our greatest desire at that moment, so it's ultimately in a way selfish, quote unquote, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that's actually the means that God put in place for societies and for people to actually operate. So, and I think that's one of the ways that he can sovereignly direct the world, by giving desires and putting things in front of people and things like that. One of the ways. So the reason my daughter is learning how to ride her bike really well, which is good, is because she's sort of got this sibling rivalry with her brother, which, you know, has sinful tendencies, sinful things mixed in with it. But I don't think it's a bad thing that she's doing it. And so that's true for us. Like we see other people that we respect and we want to be sort of like them and in a Christ-like way. And we push to do that because that's our desire and things like that. And then I think it even goes into the ultimate level where God created the world for the purpose of being glorified. He didn't do it for no reason. And he didn't do it selflessly in the sense that there's no benefit to him. He wanted to be glorified. He had a purpose in it. And then Christ on the cross, what we would call the most selfless act in the world, he had a reason to do it, which benefited him, which is he was purchasing a bride for himself, right? So everything in the world is beneficial, and you know, even God is doing things for a purpose which ultimately is good for him. And I think that's not a wrong way to think about things. But with Raleigh, the conversation I had, it opened up the question of like, is there any selfless act at all? And I think that if you define selfless as like literally does nothing for you at all, I don't think there is like a ultimately selfless act, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, I don't.
I know it's kind of, it's pretty deep, and I don't know. But
yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying. It seems like it shouldn't be that way. Like, there should be selfless acts, but
well, selfless. I mean, it could be even if it's like a mother, I don't know, jumping in front of a train for her kids or something like crazy like that. You want to say that's a selfless act, but ultimately,
there's a biological advantage.
Well, but ultimately, she viewed the safety of her child as more valuable than her own. So she made a decision. I want my son to live more than me. So she did what she wanted. You know, like, nobody doesn't do what they want. You weigh it, even if it's a split second. You weigh it and you do the thing that you want the most all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I thought it was a interesting thing to talk about.
No, it is. I just can't. That's such a big question. Like, is there any selfless acts? I think, like, even looking at the cross, you think to yourself, okay, if I'm going to go to, you know, if I'm the first place I'm going to go is think about, like, the cross. But God was bringing glory to himself too.
Yep.
So,
and ultimately, that's the main, the main purpose.
Yeah, ultimately.
For it.
Exactly. So, but that's tough. Like, I don't know. That's a hard question to answer.
All right. Well, big. Thought I'd throw it out there. We'll see what people think.
Yeah. Get some responses.
You want to play a game?
Yeah.
All right. We're going to play Would You Rather. Last Would You Rather did not go so well, if you remember correctly.
I remember. White was on board with that.
I'll never forget.
I'll never forget getting shot down.
I want to bring redemption.
Getting shot down over Whiteland.
Would you rather, Tanner, have all your loved ones turned into cheese statues that you then have to eat, or have to breastfeed a woodpecker for the rest of your life?
Oh my gosh.
I'm opening the floor for questions.
Okay. Wait, what is the woodpecker doing?
You're breastfeeding the woodpecker.
So basically the woodpecker is just like jamming its beak into my breast.
Jamming
its, my breast.
It's woodpecker beak into your chest.
Your
nipple, specifically.
My nipple. So here lies the question, the biggest question of the night.
Okay.
Day, morning.
Morning.
Do I lactate?
Of course, yes.
Okay, so I'm a lactating male. Am I male?
Yes.
These are all important questions.
Okay.
Because if I'm female, this one's out.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't want to be a woman.
What? You sound like...
Poor women. No, I could never be a woman. I could never deal with all the stuff they deal with. What are you looking at me like that for? No, it's the truth. Like, having babies and...
Just dangerous ground. But yeah, I'm right there with you. It is. It's
babies and menstruation is enough to keep me from being a woman.
Okay.
Did I make you uncomfortable with the word menstruation?
Do we have a title? Do we have an episode title somewhere there?
Okay, so I'm not a woman, but I'm lactating. And a woodpecker is the woodpecker getting nutrients from
of course. Yeah, is the way it eats.
But that's how he gets like grubs in a tree, not milk.
In this case, he's getting the milk out of your breast through his
as he continues to poke holes in my
like jackhammer like head.
As he continues to poke holes in my breast, does milk squirt in all directions? Like, is it coming out of multiple holes?
At first, yeah, but
and then
know,
it just deflates.
No. Over time, your body kind of adjusts to it. It's like, all right, this is the way I'm gonna.
I get calloused nipples.
Yeah, and then
do I have any sensitivity left in my nipples?
Eventually, not so much, but at first, it hurts real bad.
Okay. So no sensitivity left in the nipples.
That's an important one. Why do all of our would you rathers end up with you asking the question, how's my nipple sensitivity in this one?
Have you ever seen Four Christmases?
No.
She's talking about like breastfeeding her fourth child. And she's like, after the second one, I had no feeling left in my nipples at all. And she looks at her and she goes, you want to flick one?
Jeez.
Anyways, it's a funny movie. Check it out.
Cool. Sounds good.
Okay, so, all right. I think we've pretty much covered the woodpecker one.
Wow, there's so much more.
So much more?
Well, the possibilities are endless. But, okay, the other one is, would you have all your loved ones turned into cheese statues that you then have to eat?
Are they, so that, like my loved ones are permanently gone?
Well, they exist as cheese statues.
And then I have to eat them?
You have to eat them.
What kind of cheese? I shouldn't even be asking that. It's like the question should immediately be, "I'll take the woodpecker," because if my wife hears that,
there's so many.
You're asking me so to choose destroying my entire family over a woodpecker, but I'll oblige. So what kind of cheese?
Depending on how much you love each loved one, they turn into the cheeses that you love the most, descending to the cheeses that you don't like very much.
Okay. How much time do I have to eat the cheese?
You have over the course of the rest of your life.
Oh, but cheese goes bad.
Yeah.
That's going to be a problem.
So it's going to get moldy.
Yeah. It's only all the people you love, so if you love a lot of people, it's going to be a lot of cheese. But
are we talking like agape love or...
No, just Phileo.
Phileo love.
No big deal, just Phileo.
Less, I'm going to end up eating you as a block of cheese.
Oh, crap.
You're dead in this scenario.
Okay, well, that's fine.
No more podcast. What do the listeners want? Do the listeners want to lose their podcast?
Let me turn around. Let me give you a quick, a free one. So once you have eaten and consumed the entire person and passed them through your body, they reconvene and they're alive again as normal people.
Oh, normal. So they don't reconvene.
They're not cheese again.
They don't reconvene as feces?
Well, no. They change from that into back into
after
their
being flushed down the
form.
Toilet.
Yeah, and it's they don't like form in the sewer. They
reincarnate. Are you posing a reincarnation scenario on a Christian podcast?
They magically like with sparkles and swirls, they reappear in their own home,
but not as like so they're not babies.
No,
they're
no,
like
no.
full grown.
Back
where
to where they were when they turned into the cheese, but you have to consume them before they can come back.
Okay, so I can eat all the cheese and they come back.
Yep.
Well, that's really not a bad scenario.
Yeah.
Can I sell the cheese? Do I have to eat the cheese?
You have to eat the cheese, in order for them to be brought back.
Okay, so I could sell you. And I'm just kidding.
Wow.
Okay.
You good?
I think so. You're supposed to close the floor.
Yeah, I know. You don't want to ask any more questions, though?
I
this woodpecker going to town on your
I mean, we've covered lack of sensitivity.
Uh-huh.
We've covered milk
which
was
the
squirting,
most important.
Milk squirting all over the place. We've covered how uncomfortable you are with the word menstruation.
Uh-huh.
I said it again.
Yeah. I'm closing the floor for questions.
Okay.
Tanner, would you rather have all your loved ones turned into cheese statues that you then have to eat or have to breastfeed a woodpecker for the rest of your life?
I'm going to go with cheese statues.
Cheese statues! You have to. That's a lot of people, though, right? I hope.
Yeah.
You love a lot of people.
I'll just, before it happens, I'll like get in a lot of fights with my friends. And then we won't have a guy. And then I'll be like, sorry, man. See what happens?
I don't Phileo you.
You see what happens when I Phileo you? See all these people made of cheese? I was doing you a favor.
Well, then you're showing them love. That's like selfless love. Now they're like the best cheese.
No, they can't be turned to cheese after the first run. I'm making the rules now.
But you loved them. You sacrificially
hated them. I just don't
want to
have
them.
Man boobs, which would be required if I was lactating. You got to store that milk somewhere.
All right. I guess so. I mean... All right, so people
so
cheese.
Cheese it is.
I turn into cheese, I pass through your body, and then we start a podcast again.
How does that feel?
I don't like it.
It's like an episode of the Magic School Bus or something.
The worst episode of the Magic School Bus.
Did you see that episode?
The one where they ate all their friends?
Yeah.
And they magically reconstituted in front of them?
Yeah.
Next topic, Tanner. What you got, buddy?
Okay. I want to talk about Richard Dawkins, everybody's favorite angry atheist.
Uh-huh.
There was an article that I came across about this person, wrote an article from the Huffington Post, kind of disagreeing and scolding Dawkins for him going too far by calling Christians childish. So I'll just read this excerpt from this, and then I want to talk about like this approach by atheists at trying to, intellectually... bring religion down. If there's an intellectual totem pole, they try to put it at the bottom. And I don't know, just I want to talk about that. So here's her quote. She says, "It's all very well to assert that it's childish or primitive to believe in God. As Dawkins must know, the difference between fairy tales and religious belief is that there comes a time in a person's life when societal consensus deems it no longer seemly to believe in the former. Likewise, no one would find it cute if they moved in with their boyfriend, only to find that come Christmas, he was hanging out his stockings and leaving a glass of Advocate for Santa." That must be some British thing. is that like a different word for milk in British?
I have no idea.
There is no such consensus over belief in God. Far from it. No British Prime Minister and no U.S. President has thus far agreed with Dawkins that belief in God is silly and irrational. People are not yet ready to hear it, and ramming it down their throats just closes minds rather than opening them.
So is this someone that is not religious but is saying, yo, chill out on...
Yeah, she's basically saying she's an atheist, and she's saying, like, if you want to open minds to atheism, you can't ignore the fact that people are emotionally invested in these beliefs and try to make them out like they just believe in Santa Claus.
Interesting.
And I don't know. I wanted to hear your thoughts on this approach by atheists, and how they try to compare our belief in God with that of Santa Claus or, other fairy tales or whatever. And, I mean, my take on it is it's just kind of like an intellectual, like, bully kind of move. Like, I'm smarter than you, and I don't believe in something that I can't see, and everything I believe in is science, even though they might not be able to explain the science. I mean, Dawkins has proved that many times where he doesn't understand a lot of the theories he talks about. He doesn't have answers to, you know, what the scientists actually found. He just takes it as fact because it was in a scientific journal and peer-reviewed by everybody else who has a bias towards what those people are saying.
Well, I think that like militant attitude against religion on the part of atheists, I feel like it's a more consistently atheist approach. What is a consistent atheist? That's a big question anyways, but I feel like when I come across an atheist that is open
minded. A consistent atheist is an inconsistent believer in God.
Of course. So yeah, I'm not saying they're actually consistent. I'm saying they're closer to consistent. At least as far as their atheism goes, if that's their ultimate belief. But so when I talk to atheists, and most of the ones that I talk to are kind, and they're willing to have discussions, and they're open-minded, and they want to engage, but there's this underlying, their actual, like, outlook on the subject is just as militant, but they're much nicer about it, and they don't want to be offensive and shove it down people's throats, because, you know, they're actually in workplaces, they're actually in societies where they have to function and be nice to people, unlike Dawkins, apparently.
Yeah, that's not my experience, but my experiences are mostly in the university. Very, very, like hostile.
Right. So I feel like the nicer an atheist is that I talk to, the more open-minded they are to actually hear out what I'm saying, the less consistent they actually are. But I think that's a good thing, because ultimately atheism is a completely inconsistent worldview. And I get to find those footholds much easier. Like, oh, here, here, and here, these things don't match up. Let me point these things out to you and, you know, show you how God solves your inconsistencies. But, you know, but then at the same time, I guess, if you flip that, if you're a consistent atheist, I guess there's a lot of different ways to look at it, but you shouldn't be militant towards religion, because religion is clearly just a vestigial evolutionary necessity, right? It's something that we came up with in order to function as a society, and we need it, or we have needed it at least. So you shouldn't be angry towards it. You should see it for what it is, and just realize that you're smart enough to have gotten over it.
Well, and the whole premise behind it is that he's saying that, like, if you were to say to Dawkins, well, why aren't you writing books against, you know, the belief in Santa Claus if you're so against things that aren't real? And he would say, because millions of people or billions of people aren't being deceived into giving money and following all these rules and regulations based on Santa Claus. But that assumes that for people to believe in something and give money to it, or to live a life following some code that's supposedly written by this deity, that assumes, his criticism of it assumes that such a thing is wrong. That believing and make-believe things and telling other people about, like, one of his biggest criticisms is, like, parents who tell their kids about God and teach their kids about God, and he says that it's, you know, it's a crime to take advantage of, you know, the spongy brain of a child and feed them that stuff. And he goes on and on about how his mother, you know, didn't, you know, was always, you know, kind of the one who planted the ideas about the world in him. But he assumes so much when he criticizes Christians or other religious people for their practices and saying that those practices are evil. That ultimately what Dawkins is saying is that belief in God and telling others to believe in God and supporting institutions that believe in God and institutions that are having other people teaching other people or involving other people in the belief of God are ultimately evil, because they're causing belief in something that doesn't exist. It's not based on science.
Right. Why is believing in something that doesn't exist wrong?
Exactly.
And like I'm saying, what if, as an atheist, how do you know that believing in these things isn't actually advantageous to the species? You know, what if you're actually cleansing out something that we need?
Sure.
As an atheist, how do you know? So you now have this greater understanding of the way humanity should work, and it's now up to Richard Dawkins to cleanse out this thing that apparently we've needed for billions of years to function, and now it's up to Dawkins to get rid of it. What if you're wrong? What if this isn't better for us to be enlightened to this atheistic truth?
Even if it's just for, you know, humanists would say that they have a morality. But that morality is nowhere near the morality that's created, you know, through the law of God.
And they're clearly making it up as they go. He's saying that believing in God is evil. Why? Because Richard Dawkins says so? That doesn't even make you have no, you know, obviously that's our knee-jerk argument. You have no authority for your morality. You have no basis for what you're saying. And it's clear
and,
there.
Yeah, and you can go even deeper. Like, what is childhood? What is childish? You know, and really getting in the deep down, like, these words have no meaning in a worldview that has no foundation for, you know, metaphysics and things like that. So, you know, what's childish to me isn't necessarily childish to Richard Dawkins and vice versa. And so his definition of what he's saying and accusing Christianity of, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same as mine. So there's a lot of problems there, but I think ultimately it comes down to the fact that he is saying, he's talking about being childish in religion as a negative, as a bad thing, when in reality it doesn't necessarily universally apply. So I think that's
there's no basis for it at all.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, you want to get into Everybody in the Pub?
Yes.
Cool.
I do.
I'll talk about some of our good friends on Twitter who have found the show, and they are letting people know that they like it. The Right America, Clay Winters, Angry Toast, Matt Coldegelly, 1/99 Ministries, Stephanie Trejo, Tanner Cox, Stephen Sherrill, Andrew Norman, Joshua Bug, and Nathan Koffler. These are people that that liked our show. They and wanted to let everybody know about it. Thank you guys so much for letting other people know. That's how our show gets around, just word of mouth. So thank you so much. We really, 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 really appreciate it.
All right. So you put up a question on Facebook, and it was question for episode 34. What was your favorite age and why? Les, what was your favorite age?
Current age? Seems like a lot of people felt that way too. I I don't know. I guess this past year has been a little rough because I'm super busy. But right now, like this time in my life is definitely the best. Like my my marriage is, you know, it's we're aging together and we're
that sounds so much fun.
We're like our
we're
kids
aging together.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Like the beginning of my marriage was a little more rocky than it is now, and I feel like we've kind of gotten used to each other, and we actually love each other, and I feel a more deep way. You know, our kids are at a point where they're asking all kinds of awesome questions, and so we're like, I'm seeing how to shape my children into something awesome, and I don't know. It's just I think the key for me though is that I think childhood is the worst. Like everybody says, like enjoy your childhood, kid, because once you get older, it's all downhill from there. Like I think that's totally wrong. I think being a kid sucks, because you're always making mistakes, always getting in trouble. Like I look at my son and we're like constantly punishing him for like his behavior and stuff, and I know it's all for the better, like he's learning how to function in society and be obedient to God, but that just seems like a miserable existence. Fortunately, he's resilient, so he doesn't like you know, get sad or anything about it. He bounces right back after he gets punished. But I don't know. Childhood, I don't find to be a very good time for. I don't know why people think it's the best.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, for me, I really enjoyed. And it's not to discount like the fact that I love my family and I love my kids and I love where I'm at. But as far as like if I think about an age for me that I just had a lot, like just a ton of fun, it's probably like 18 or 19. Like
yeah.
I had moved out when I was 17. I was roofing. I was making a ton of money roofing, and I was I was renting a room from a friend. And I was playing in multiple bands and we were playing a lot, like all over the place. And I just had this huge core group of friends that we just all used to hang out at that, he lived with his parents, but the whole like bottom part of they had a huge home and the whole bottom part of their home was pretty much like theirs. And we'd play shows there and we'd have like parties all the time. We'd have like Xbox LAN parties it was just fun. It was a time in my life where I was surrounded by really great people. Like everybody I was hanging out with was, you know, like people like Christian, you know, guys who were in Christian bands. It was a big Christian group. And it was just a really positive time in my life. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't dating anybody. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't doing any of that, which is always in high school, dating was a nightmare for me. So yeah. It was just a time where I was like really just hanging out with friends and something I felt like I really missed out in high school and playing music. And, I don't know, just, you know, I don't know, just maybe kind of a transition period for me that was really fun. And, but you know, I have a hard time choosing because I also loved being a kid and waking up and watching, you know, the Batman the Animated Series, and I don't know. I mean, I can find things about every age, probably besides middle school. I hated middle school; it was the worst. I think I went through a weird pudgy phase in middle school, and girls like hated me and thought I was like the grossest thing ever, I don't know, but besides that, I can find something really great about every age. Like there's been moments in every age that I've really enjoyed. But
well, that definitely reminds me of I guess I was like 19, 20 when I became a Christian, came to Florida. That whole time in my life where I literally had nothing, no possessions, and it was watching manna like rain from heaven every day, and it was incredible.
That's exactly what I'm
spiritually. Yeah. It was the most incredible time in my life because it was just watching all these things fall in place perfectly, like God paving this road before my feet that literally wasn't there the day before. That was a pretty incredible.
It was just
time.
Exciting because I, you know, it was like for the first time in my life, I was on my own. I was completely responsible for myself, and it was just really fun. It was really fun to kind of like, I don't know, discover that, you know, and do it with really good friends and constantly be in the company of really cool people. So, but anyways, other people on Facebook had stuff to say, and Oh man, Facebook on iPad. You're the bane of.
A lot of people definitely went with their adulthood. A lot of people said like their current age too. We got Sean Roman says 25. Now I love my family and how much God has blessed me. Corey Lillard says he loved being 37. The Lord, my wife, my kids are all good. Yeah, so
I hear people say like people who've made it through their 30s or in their 30s a lot of times say that the 30s are their favorite.
That makes sense.
I don't know if it's just because our society is moving. We're getting married later. We're kind of blooming in our careers later. Things kind of just like you get through all the, like you're saying right now, like you and your wife are starting to get like figure out how to like really live together
to function
and you're in your 30s. So
yeah. Cause like your 20s are you like learning how to do life and you suck at it because you're basically still like immature, so it's like this clash of immaturity, but you have to grow up. So your 20s are like figuring out how to grow up, and then your 30s is like actually like settling into that. So it's like now you're responsible, but you know how to be responsible, and you I don't know, and you're not old yet.
It seems like it's a toss up between like early 20s. Like a lot of people said 19.
I think most of these people that are putting 20s and 30s are just putting their actual age.
Yeah.
Steve Jennings, I think he's older than 21, but he said 21 was his favorite age because he could drink and that's when he got married.
Yeah, it seems to be people who have made it to their 30s, say 30s, but people who are still in their 20s and probably have bachelor's degrees and working at Starbucks are saying like early 20s before yeah. that happened. Because it sucks now. Like everybody goes to college and in your 20s, I work at the hospital, but my position, I'm not even using my bachelor's degree at my position, you know? So, So I look forward to being like kind of settled in that and in my 30s. And I think that'll be exciting.
Yeah. I think it's rad. Cool.
Do not covet your neighbor's age.
Do you have any recommendations, Tanner?
I do. I recently picked up a book called Brewing Classic Styles by John Palmer and Jamil Zainashef. They're like big guys on the Brewing Network. And I've been meaning to get this book because it has basically like every style in the BJCP guide, which is the Brewing Judges Certification something. Anyways, so that the BJCP guide has, it lists every style of recognized beer and they give guidelines for what those beers should be like, what kind of malts and everything. So Jamil Zainashef and John Palmer compiled a book with like 80 something recipes that hit every single one of these styles, and they're pretty just basic award-winning recipes. If you're looking like we got into a conversation, someone was looking for Father's Day gifts and they were wondering, should I get my husband a brewing kit? And I think that like my suggestion was for most people, brewing is something that like it's kind of personal preference what kind of equipment you want to get. So my recommendation is always to get some books to encourage, you know, if you're a wife and you want to get, you know, your husband's showed interest, get him some books so that he can kind of decide what kind of equipment he wants to get based on. Because the books like How to Brew by John Palmer and even In Brewing Classic Styles goes over different types of equipment. And so probably those two books are my two recommendations. How to Brew by John Palmer and Brewing Classic Styles.
Awesome.
For the home brewer.
I would like to recommend a new podcast by two people, a podcast spawned out of the pub itself. Adam Moore and Zeb Carpenter started a podcast called Reformed and Reloaded. It's all about guns.
Guns and
Christianity.
And Christianity.
They have at least their first episode up. I don't know if there's a second one up yet.
Does it? I would say that there'd be a lot of drinking. I say it gets pretty political.
Yes.
It's pretty political, yeah. It was really good. I listened to it. They did a great job.
Yeah, they absolutely
did. It's better than our first episode, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. and Zeb's got that super deep manly voice as well.
Yeah, but no Sperry's. He does not wear Sperry's.
Which isn't really that manly. But he probably has pockets full of knives.
And Slipknot CDs.
Slipknot CDs. So check it out. I don't think that there's a website. I don't know.
There is a website.
There is a website.
There is a website.
Just Google it. Reformed or Reloaded.
I think he has it through Libsyn, the host, Libsyn.
That's right. But there's also a Facebook group, Reformed and Reloaded, or a Facebook page, something like that. Check it out. Google it. You'll find it. Facebook it. Listen to it. Love it. Shoot it.
Shoot something.
Shoot something.
You're gonna shoot something.
You're gonna want to shoot something. When you're done.
It's gonna be like that one meme with the guy reloading. Do I have to do everything around here?
Yeah, that's from the Big Lebowski.
Yeah, so you'll be doing that.
Am I the only one around here that listens to Reformed and Reloaded? I hope not. Go listen to that. So, guys, if you'd like to contact us, you can join our Facebook group called The Reformed Pub. You can follow us on Twitter at Reformed Pubcast. You can email us reformedpub@gmail.com, and you can always leave us voicemails by calling 772-405-7327. Please remember to go to iTunes to rate and review us. We were in What's Hot again this week, which is super rad. I think it's pretty rad. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Reformed Pubcast. We hope that you enjoyed listening to it at least half as much as we enjoyed making it.
I'll settle for a quarter as much.
Yeah, whatever. We obviously enjoyed it. Hopefully you kind of did. We'll see what happens. Until next week,
cheers
and amen. Yo.
Ever talked about doctrine while sipping some ale? Well, I've been fixing to tell where you've been missing yourself. The theology of Calvin and the thirst of Luther. Faithful consumers of the craft brewers. Talking theology with a cup at the pub, right? If you're drinking Bud Light, then I'ma start a pub fight. Let's talk about Christ who died for like 3 days. Here without delay and grab your IPAs. This is heavy like holding a bazooka. What topic hotter than the cold for your hookah? Hear an episode while riding your car. Talking Christ at the bars with pipes and cigars. Glorifying and enjoying God is our one task. Gotta make the fun last, so don't drink it dumb fast. If it hasn't gone flat, then it makes us so glad. Bring your own glass, it's Reformed Pubcast.